Yeah, that's right. We're listening to the Beastie Boys this morning. And you know what? If we're going to do that, we're going to let it play for just a little bit because we don't do that a lot. And I think that's cool. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. It's Friday. Oh, thank God. And it's the 28th of March. And we thank you all for being with us and hope you are good and everything is fine. And we are with you. So let us move forward as we try to make sense of the world we live in at this point. We have a great group to do it. Really a wonderful, wonderful group of people. Some new, I shouldn't say new, both of them have already been on the program, but we welcome them back and we're very excited to have them back on the program. So let me get to the introductions, a reminder that you always can be a part of the program by going to panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, is in the house. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. A little tired. Went to the Capital Region Chamber dinner last night.
Oh, that's always a...
Got home a little on the late side. Yeah. It was good. It was very, very nice.
Oh, they're always fun. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Where do they hold it?
In the Capital Center.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah. Well, good.
A lot of nicely dressed people.
Oh. Well... That's the time to do it, right?
Yeah,
that's good.
I've heard it called adult prom.
It is. Yeah, it's like the adult prom. Cool. No, I actually tried to find a place where I could like get my hair done because I'm completely incompetent at that, and nobody had any time. Like, it was all booked.
Well, that is like prom.
Yeah, right? So I'm, you know, I wasn't as nice looking as everyone else, so I had forced to do my own hair. Oh, my.
Joe saying, oh, it is like prom, with the understanding that this hairstyle has not changed since I was 7 months old. So,
wow.
That's pretty much it. We welcome Siena College professor is the order of those words that I would like to speak of economics. Aaron Pacitti, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I loved hearing the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've had, can I dork out for 15 seconds?
Do it, man.
You're a dork all the time.
you know, it's they have had one of the most interesting trajectories of any band because they started out as like a hardcore punk band in the early 80s and then morphed into this funky hip hop sensation in the 90s and
slightly more mainstream,
a little more mainstream,
yeah,
a lot more mainstream,
yeah.
But their early stuff is, I really like that stuff too.
I don't know. Are we doing any early stuff, Mike?
Mike, play the first EP. All right, I'm finished.
Maybe next time, Mike says. Yeah, I think we want to keep our license. Thank you. Well, that's cool. That's very good. We also welcome economist working as associate professor of economics at Bard College, president of, is it Levy?
Levy Economics Institute.
Levy Economics Institute and expert at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Pavlina Cherneva, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you back.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you so much. And we welcome Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and since 2023 has been President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. It's good to know that we still have world affairs. Karen Riedel, thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure.
It's a pleasure being here.
Thank you so much for being on the program. All right, let's get started. We always welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, two really big stories that I want to talk about today. One, of course, is the Elise Stefanik nomination being pulled. That is not only a big story nationally, even internationally, but it's certainly a big story locally. I believe Aaron and I are the two in the room who have Ms. Stefanik as our representative. So it is a story that is close to us geographically. But I'm going to start off with the judge's order regarding the Signal chat on the Houthi attack. And so... Judge James Boasberg said top officials, including the defense secretary, the national security advisor, and the secretary of state, must preserve the messages they exchange. This is the story from the New York Times.
A federal judge in Washington on Thursday ordered several Trump administration officials who participated in a Signal group chat discussing the details of a pending attack on Yemen to preserve all of the messages they exchanged on the app in the days leading up to the strikes. The decision by the judge came in response to a lawsuit filed this week by a nonprofit watchdog group, American Oversight, which has accused President Trump's national security team of violating federal records laws by using Signal, an encrypted commercial platform, to chat about the highly sensitive attack on the Houthi rebels in Yemen. The order by Judge Boasberg, who sits in federal district court in Washington, applied to top administration officials, including Mr. Trump's national security advisor, Michael Waltz, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Vice President J.D. Vance. It covered the period between March 11th and March 15th as the administration was putting together its plans to attack the Houthis. That from the New York Times. Let us start with you, Karen Riedel.
Well, thank you. What a story. And there is so much in there, and I cannot quite, I think about it every day. What is the most interesting, most significant aspect of this scandal? And to me, I think, at least today, to me, it is the fact that this is the first time where this administration's approach to creating an alternative reality to justify their policies is questioned across the board by all members of all political parties, because unlike claims such as Zelensky is a dictator and Ukraine is the aggressor, in this case, it is very easy to look at the evidence that is right in front of us and for everybody to read that this is, in fact, of course, information that should have been classified, that the information that was discussed on Signal was something that should not have been discussed on a platform such as Signal. And this is not only clear now to Democrats, but also Republicans. A poll today found that more than 60% of Republicans feel that this is a very serious violation. And so for the first time, the administration's approach to just claiming this is nothing, this is irrelevant, this was not classified, is something for everyone to see is not reality. And so for me, this is probably the biggest, most important aspect of this scandal, that for the first time we all, across the board, in a bipartisan manner, can see what the reality is.
So orbs of steel here, but this judge not only was the one who set down this order, but also was the judge who ordered the stop in the deportation of individuals to El Salvador. Already fighting with the administration, the administration had floated the idea of impeaching him, and had been slapped down by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So then to have this on top of it, of course he is the judge in Washington, so that makes sense. But man.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're supposedly randomly assigned. There's a, you know, the cases are randomly assigned, and it's interesting that this guy ends up with the case. But you wonder how many judges were assigned it initially who turned it down. So it just ended up on his plate.
Like, right? Just took that ping pong ball and threw it back in the machine. Yeah, I'm out of this one.
Yeah.
Aaron.
On that point, it's just a matter of time before this judge gets in the crosshairs of the Trump administration and the bullying, threatening removal, or just whatever else would happen from that. So, you know, that's a part of the Trump administration's playbook. The other issue is just a straight-up competence issue, is that, you know, when I'm texting people myself, even not highly sensitive military information, like, I've made a few errors in my day of including people that I shouldn't have, and but it's not information like that. So, it's a really impressive lack of competence that we see with this. It also makes me wonder, and this is just speculation, of, like, well, this is the time they got caught. So what else is happening and what else is being communicated over, non-secure government channels?
And I just want to finish that sentence. This is the first time they got caught because they included a journalist in the chat.
Right.
Go on.
Yeah, exactly.
who did the right thing.
Yes.
Like he deserves well played. A ton of credit. Yeah.
I think so. But go ahead. I apologize.
My bigger concern is that, the judge made this ruling, and I will be curious to see whether the Trump administration actually complies with this ruling. Because with the, January 6th commission, there were all these subpoenas, and people just don't, just because somebody says you have to do something, even if it's a judge or a congressional committee, doesn't mean you're going to get cooperation from the administration. So I expect this to get ugly fast and to get dragged out. And I also suspect that, and this is also part of the Trump playbook, is that when there is an embarrassing story that comes out that casts them in a bad light, normally in a day or two that follows, there'll be some preposterous assertion that diverts people's attention away from this issue and puts something else on the front page, whether that was the car tariffs that were announced yesterday or whether there'll be something today. But, the distract and deflect approach is definitely part of this. So as this heats up, I've already braced myself mentally and psychologically for the
wag the dog.
Yes, whatever is going to come out of the administration's mouth.
Yeah, maybe to throw another perspective into this whole discussion, when Trump was elected, so many commentators were saying, okay, well, maybe we will kind of end the era of endless wars. Maybe we're going to de-escalate, remove ourselves from the international stage and not pursue these various aggressions. And actually, my question on this attack is, did they get congressional authorization? And we just seem to be caught in this loop and post, I would say, Bush Jr. era of endless strikes, endless wars, without going to Congress, without hashing it out, without declaring war. And, we're caught in this absurdity and this incompetence. In the old days, when a journalist would break a story like this that was done in some kind of, backstage, dark room, that was, really celebrated. And I think we are celebrating the fact that the journalist did the right thing. But I think we also need to be asking the question, what are these guys doing? And are we going to stop, these strikes with impunity without the democratic process, which, as we see, is just going the democratic process is being sabotaged on many fronts.
Just like at least they weren't on Facebook Messenger.
At least they use Signal, right?
Like, yeah.
Well done.
Yeah, not FaceTime this time, right? Yes.
Okay. I would like to add on to that. So it of course the president is has power to move troops into volatile regions of the world without congressional approval. That is the president's power. But what's really interesting when you read through this chat is that the president was not actually clearly aware of it. So this is the bigger issue here, I think. Constitutionally, the president does have the power to move troops without initial congressional approval. And of course, this is not the first administration that has attacked the Houthis. This is not this doesn't really per se require a war declaration, but it should require the president's approval, and quite clearly that was not the case.
So can I just bore down on that for a moment? We've got just about a minute before we go, so I'll probably make the statement, then we can talk about it when we come back. But what I find so interesting about what you just said and the overall concept of it is that it seems within the messages that there was an edict, there was a decision that was made by the president, and then this group of individuals was interpreting it as to what it meant and how they were going to do that. It seems that would be natural. The thing that was missing was the next step, which is then you go back to the president and say, this is what we're doing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Right. And because the emojis were flying before, like, actually.
Yeah.
The thumbs up and the
bicep
flexing, yeah. Yes. So that all happened prior to apparently, and even after this, if he, I don't know, is true to his word, and God only knows, but of saying, you know, I knew nothing about this until you brought this up to me, reporter in the room. 5 days later is pretty startling. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with this wonderful group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return to the discussion after this news from the BBC. Good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable for this 28th of March, and we are knee-deep in a conversation about the judge who moves to prevent those who were on the Signal group chat to preserve all of the messages that they exchanged on the app in the days leading up to the strikes, James Boasberg being the judge, and was in response to a lawsuit at a hearing in federal district court in Washington on Thursday. Judge Boasberg made clear that he had issued his preservation order to be sure that none of the Signal messages were lost, not because he had made a finding that administration officials had done anything wrong. American Oversight, which often seeks to pry loose information from the government under the Freedom of Information Act, has claimed that the administration's use of Signal to discuss the attack plans violated the Federal Records Act, which requires official communications by agency officials to be preserved. That, again, from the New York Times. But the thing here is that with Signal, these are messages that would normally then disappear.
Well, there's a setting where you can do that. They don't automatically, and you can set how at what time frame they disappear.
So the judge is saying, go to your settings.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
hold on to that.
I think, I mean, you can set it so that they disappear after 4 weeks or 2 weeks or whatever. But I don't know if there's a setting where they could never disappear. I guess you could just put infinity in there as.
Well, yeah. That's what I use.
Right.
I'm not hiding anything. So right. There is that setting. I wonder if Signal is. I wonder if Signal has these on a server somewhere, though. Just because they're deleted from your phone doesn't mean they're permanently deleted. And I would think a company like Signal would probably have to, for a variety of reasons.
I mean, they're encrypted, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why they use the Signal app is because they're encrypted. So it may it's possible that they're not hanging out on a server somewhere, but. I mean, they're supposed to do this in a SCIF, and I have no idea what that stands for, but unfortunately they've been talking about SCIF for days now, and it's like a special secret room where you go and have these special secret conversations.
Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility.
Yeah, and I guess, like, senior officials have these in their homes, and if they want
to. Like the Secretary of Defense?
Yeah. Yeah, like if you want to go have a conversation like this, you're supposed to go to your SCIF, shut the door, it's soundproof and all that, and it's supposed to make sure that the communication is secure. It sounds to me like super old-fashioned, I guess, because if there's end-to-end encryption on an app and, you don't include somebody who shouldn't be on accidentally, don't know if that is actually more or less secure than a SCIF. I have no idea. I mean, you're still in a SCIF. You're still on a phone or something.
Yeah, but right? I think the SCIF is designed to prevent including people who should not be part of the conversation, which is the issue.
Yeah,
here.
And I said earlier, I mean, this reporter, I listened to an interview with him, and he basically said he got invited to this group, and he was like, well, this has got to be fake. And then the conversation starts, and he's like, this can't be right. So instead of reporting it or putting it out there, he waited to see what actually happened, and it did.
As the bomb started to drop,
yeah. And so you know, give him credit. He didn't do anything in advance that would have risked, you know, the security of, you know, that it wouldn't have tipped the hat to anybody else. Like, he kept the information to himself, which I give him a lot of credit for that. I can't say that a lot of reporters, I think, would have immediately went like, aha, look at this. And he didn't. And he didn't release the content until they said it was not classified.
Right. And the other thing, too, and I agree with you, the other thing I would add, too, is that even in his reporting, he initially did not report everything.
Right.
And was very careful as to what he included and what he didn't. Not necessarily that that should be his job, but nobody else was doing it. So, by the way, SCIF can also stand for the Shotokan Karate International Federation. So
that is way cooler.
Yeah.
But can I just want to emphasize again how I applaud the judge for making this ruling, emphasizing that he's not making a ruling on whether anything was done wrong or not, but it serves as a reminder that we need to have access to these documents down the road for historical purposes, and especially in this day and age where alternative realities are so very powerful, right? And again, we saw the limits of it, but we only have the limits if we have access to the information available. Mm-hmm. And whether or not they're going to be preserved, it is a reminder, and it's a reminder to the public at large that we need to have access to this information, not just for now, but for future purposes.
So the idea of... well, let's get to some letters. Barry writes, I never met that person, at which point people post dozens of pictures of them together over the years. Two, this is the first I hear of it. Sometimes hard to disprove, but given his relationship with the truth, ... Seriously, folks, count how many times you've heard those words from his mouth. Ready excuses, and we need to stop accepting them. Last comment directed at the general media. Any thoughts on that?
He didn't know. Trump claimed to not know about Project 2025, so.
Well, he didn't read it, which I find very credible.
No, that, yeah, you, no, fair point, fair point. Yeah, no, that's just him. I mean, we're never going to be able to prove or disprove that claim, but just saying that he was unaware of it or didn't know about this is debatable.
I forget things all the time, though. I forget what I had for breakfast, you know. So maybe he knew and then he forgot.
We go to Mary. What's as bad or even worse than car tariffs and the security breach? We know that the GOP uses drama to draw attention away from its more sinister activities, but is the news media shining a light through it? No. This time, tariffs and the security breach are successfully burying the GOP's threat to our voting rights. It is being called an immoral and illegal attempt to make it harder for us to fight back at the ballot box. We can't vote them out if we can't vote. That from Mary. Then Matt says, Trump has said he should be impeached. GOP members of Congress have echoed the statement about Judge Boasberg. The White House press secretary has attacked the judge's wife, who runs a women's health provider in Virginia, among other things, an abortion provider. And then we go to Mike. Two questions. Are top officials being directed by leadership to use Signal? Are the Russians or others really disappointed that a vulnerability they have been exploiting has been exposed? That from Mike. All right. Anyone else on that before we move on? Actually, Mike, let's take a quick break. We'll be back. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit. We'll put our economists to work on the program. Real quick, this from James. Signal does not have your message. It is designed not to. Signal servers only exist to provide routing. Once that is established, Signal largely steps out of the way, and that is from James. So we'll take his word for that until we don't. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. With car tariffs, Trump puts his unorthodox trade theory to the test. And we are going to talk a bit about the economy now. We have wonderful economists in the room, so I'd like to do that. President Trump and his supporters have clashed with mainstream economists for years about the merits of tariffs. Now the world will get to see who is right as the president's sweeping levies on automobiles and auto parts play out in real time. Experiment on the global economy. And Mr. Trump's telling tariffs have a straightforward effect. They encourage companies to move factories to the United States, creating more American jobs and prosperity. But for many economists, the effect of tariffs is anything but simple. The tariffs are likely to encourage domestic car production over the long run, they say, but they will also cause substantial collateral damage that could backfire on the president's goals for jobs, manufacturing, and the economy at large. Aaron.
So this, you know, the tariffs are part of Trump's playbook because they're easily digested by the population. They're easy headlines. There's something he can do without actually passing legislation. The problem is that they are not only ineffective at bringing back domestic jobs that have been offshored, is that they're actually going to be counterproductive and create, if they continue, very likely rising inflation, higher unemployment. So all of a sudden, for the first time since the 1970s, you're hearing economists talk about the real possibility of stagflation, which is a combination of stagnation, meaning low growth and high unemployment, and inflation. But I think a bigger point here, and the vein that Trump has tapped, is that the problems that he's claiming to address are very real. The loss of manufacturing jobs, wage stagnation, rising inequality, declining economic mobility, those are real issues. Tariffs aren't going to fix those, but what he's responding to is something that has been brewing for, you know, four decades. And the jobs that have been offshored aren't coming back, right? We're not, like Howard Lutnick was talking about, bringing sneaker manufacturing back to the U.S. Well, that's probably not going to happen. So thinking about some forward-looking type of economic policy that would actually create jobs either directly or indirectly, I think, is more important. But you're starting to see the cracks in this approach. Consumer confidence, the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey was released yesterday. Consumer confidence is the lowest it has been since January 21st. Everybody put your brain into where you were on January 2021. That was, you know, peak COVID. There was no vaccines. It was still a very scary time. So consumer sentiment has already started to plunge because people just see this uncertainty and are concerned about what's happening. You're starting to see business confidence measures go down. You're starting to see an inflection in business investment. The issue here is that putting tariffs on imported cars isn't just going to make people switch to domestic cars, because the tariffs are also imposed on car parts. So 60% of a car made by an American company are imported. So you've got Japanese electronics, you've got German circuitry, all of these things. And you know, those cars are produced in, part of it's produced in Canada, then it's shipped to Mexico, then it comes back to the U.S. So the idea that you're buying a domestic-made car is just not true. These cars are very globally integrated in terms of sourcing raw materials. So it's really unclear what he's trying to accomplish besides looking tough. I think he claims that putting tariffs in place is a way to gain leverage and to use as a bargaining chip with other countries, but in the process, he's creating collateral damage. The uncertainty that he is creating because of this is going to have very real effects on the economy, whether the tariffs remain in place or not. So to me, this is counterproductive. I think, in my own opinion, he wants car company executives, foreign politicians to come to Washington in the White House, kneel down, kiss his ring, and make him feel good about himself. And then he'll remove the tariffs and everybody looks like a winner. But there's going to be a lot of collateral damage in the process.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. They are very much a tool for negotiation. They're intended effects on the economy are going to be largely negative, although even the magnitude of it is not quite clear, because if you remember last time around, he used tariffs again as a leverage. You know, he threatened tariffs, then he will pull out tariffs or threaten them again, pull them out. So we don't know exactly where this thing is going to fall, but this is in his broad executive powers, so he can really antagonize other countries and potentially increase tariffs far more than he's threatening at the moment. You know, at Levy we did this, and we are right now looking at kind of the relationship between tariffs and jobs, etc., and the state of the manufacturing industry. And I think the greatest damage that was done to manufacturing is indeed after NAFTA. And I think this is the legitimate grievance that people are feeling and that is generating some sympathies for his policies. And it really was a fundamental restructuring and reshifting of the manufacturing sector, of production, of supply chains, how we do things. And, of course, that costs a lot of jobs. But I want to talk a little bit about jobs because this sector is a sector that's being automated. This right. is not a very labor-intensive sector. And if you look at the share of manufacturing in the total economy, it's very small. And the share of employment, in particular, the share of employment in the transportation manufacturing is something like 2% of total employment. So like 3 million jobs or something like that. So let's double the amount of manufacturing jobs. It will do something for some communities, no doubt. I very much doubt that this will do it because a tariff is a tax. A tariff is going to, you know, we've already seen, you know, price increases of cars because of supply chain disruptions during COVID. Slap a tariff on top of that, you're not going to see some robust demand for automobiles because we have tariffs. You know, as Aaron said, prices will go up, no doubt. So that's number one. But if the grievance is jobs, we need to be thinking in entirely different ways how to fix jobs, because what NAFTA did is actually weaken wages, weaken labor protections, weaken the quality of employment and the kinds of jobs that we had. And I'm not hearing this in the conversation. All I'm hearing is, let's just bring, you know, factories here. But we're not talking about stronger unions, better wages. If anything, this administration is not too sympathetic to unions. I mean, selectively, you know, is supporting some unions, but it is definitely, just today they announced that they wanted to get rid of federal unions for federal employees. So, you know, I think that if Trump is billing himself as the president who will bring back jobs, I think this is not going to happen through tariffs.
Well, I run the State Manufacturing Association, and we have manufacturers in the state that actually make component parts. And just a few things that are notable. The parts sometimes cross the border four or five times. My understanding initially, not on in this round, but my understanding initially of the tariffs was it's every border crossing. So that creates a cost issue that really makes you scratch your head. But the other thing is, universally, the manufacturers in New York and I would say across the country, and I talk to state chambers and manufacturing associations all the time, one of their biggest problems is they can't find enough workforce. We have a huge workforce shortage in manufacturing, to the point where I've, you know, spoken to manufacturers who are concerned that they can't run a full line. And it's very costly to shut down manufacturing and restart. So you want to be running your line around the clock. And they are having challenges doing that because they don't have enough people right now. So if you know, automation is a partial solution to that. And I am a very strong advocate for automation. And if anyone is really, really bored and wants to be depressed, go read the New Yorker article about the end of childhood, because it talks about the demographic cliff that we're on. We're going to have way worse workforce issues moving forward. We don't have enough people. We need to either automate or get a lot more people. Hopefully AI and automation will solve part of this. So there's a whole bunch of things that it seems counterproductive to me to try and bring, not that it's not good to have manufacturing domestically, but in a global economy, to say it all has to be done here, who's gonna run it? I'm just, it's a big question mark.
And of course, adding on to that, the obvious fact that we're not acting in a vacuum, it'll lead to a trade war. My father is a proud driver, lifelong driver of Ford cars because they're good in Germany. And they're good and they're cheaper than the BMW or Mercedes. But it's there will be tariffs, of course, put on the Fords coming into Europe, and that will make the Ford more expensive.
There is a massive Ford manufacturing facility in China in it's Chongqing, I think. 35,000 people, at least in 2017 when I was there, the number was 35,000 people work in this Ford manufacturing facility in China, which, you know, I don't know how the tariffs work if you're manufacturing in China. Is China going to put a tariff on the U.S. brand? I don't think so, but I don't know.
But can I ask the economists here, because my concern as a political scientist is always like, what is it going to do to the relationship between the countries with our allies? And obviously, it goes without saying, it's the relationship has been damaged. This is a trade deal that was made under the first Trump administration. It worked. Now it's a Trump administration that is dismantling the trade deal that worked. Do you think the relationship with our allies, based on economic perspective, can we rebuild it? Will it be rebuilt?
Think there has been permanent damage. Just today, I think Mark Carney announced our trade relationship with the United States is dead, essentially.
I think he didn't say trade relationship. I think he said relationship.
Oh, really? Yeah. maybe overall. But yes, I think that we are definitely entering a new era in global trade relationships. And it's not quite clear how we'll emerge out of this. We are so dependent integrated. We've become so interdependent over the last few decades. So I think that, you know, there will be enormous disruptions. And it would be important to see what's on the other side. What is the benefit from these disruptions? And I don't see them as an economist. I don't see them in the form of jobs. I don't see them in the form of better pay. We do hold manufacturing as a model of good jobs, right? And that should be our model to change other industries. You know, the service sector employs 80% of all people, right? Like, if we continue to, you know, elevate manufacturing jobs as this kind of dream job that gives us good communities, that, you know, supports families, then we need to be thinking about how to do this for other industries. But I'm not seeing this. You know, if we're having shortage in employment, there are ways to address these shortages. We can have vocational training. We can have on-the-job training. We can have apprenticeship programs. There are things, but those require action. Those require thought. They require actually planning by the government. And it seems that we're doing precisely the opposite in terms of destroying public capacities to embark on any of these investments.
Let me just ask a very stupid, simple question. This is what I'm best at. I'm holding in my hand a TV remote. Let's assume this is a car. It even has wheel wells. And this is a car that comes from another country. And it comes into this country. Is the entire automobile tariffed? One. And if this car that I'm holding in my, this imaginary car that I'm holding in my hand, comes from Detroit, and there are parts that are made elsewhere, that those parts are tariffed? Mm-hmm. Who keeps track of that?
The Census Bureau?
Signal.
Commerce. Isn't it Commerce?
Is it Commerce?
Yeah. Okay. Tariffs.
I mean, it just seems like that would be very difficult to figure out which widget is made where.
There are input-output tables that the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is under the Commerce Department, keeps, I know, but...
So this is my long way of asking this question, which is, so it's going to depend on the automobile of what the impact on the consumer is going to be as far as if there is a price increase.
There's Washington Post actually had a pretty good chart that did by brand the percentage of the vehicle that is made in the U.S. versus made somewhere else. And actually, if I remember right, I think Tesla was one of the most American of the vehicles, which is just an interesting
little convenient.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say it. My wife yelled at me when I threw that at her as something that I might bring up on the roundtable out the when I was walking out the door. But yeah, no, it's important to remember.
Why didn't Allison yell at you about that?
There's no evidence to support it. But I said that we're dealing with a president who operates on a transactional basis. Well, he had a car commercial for Tesla in front of the White House. So why wouldn't he impose a policy that would shift demand to a company and donor whose image and stock price are plummeting?
Meaning that that was the reason for the tariffs as opposed to the fact that because the country, the cars are made in this country, that they would not be tariffed.
Correct.
I understand. Okay.
I mean, why did he single out cars when it was, you know, for China, it's all products. For Canada, now it's energy exports. And I can't even keep track anymore. But it's curious that all of a sudden cars are now
Well, don't forget, the UAW, the union head endorsed them, right?
No. Did the No, I thought the UAW was silent and the Teamsters endorsed
them. Oh, the Teamsters. You're right.
So, but to your point, Joe, is that this is going to affect American-made cars that are made by American companies, because the concept of American-made is out the door. That with NAFTA and then China entering the World Trade Organization, the concept of made in America is very narrow.
Well, and Volkswagen manufacturers in the U.S. has Mercedes.
Right, exactly.
I mean,
Honda has plants in the U.S.
Yes, oh, you know what? I think it was Honda that was the most American component parts, not Tesla. I think Tesla was second.
Yeah.
I don't have my phone, so I can't go look at the chart. But
all right. We're going to take a break. We are late. So we'll come back. We'll talk about this. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those as well. And then more economics coming up. We have more questions and more topics to talk about. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. This is the best music for tariffs. No doubt about it. Good morning. Welcome back to the program and to the roundtable. Let me reintroduce and just tell you who is on our panel if you're just joining us. Heather Mulligan is here, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Karen Riedel, and economist and Professor of Economics at Bard College, and President of the Levy Economics Institute, Pavlina Cherneva. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you all here. All right, let's go to the letters, and then we'll do a couple more things regarding the economy and then move on. Let's see. We go to this is another Aaron. Heather forgot to mention that immigration could be helpful in finding more workers for our manufacturing facilities that you spoke about moments ago.
I agree. One of the solutions is opening up immigration, but that's a big, complicated mess, and there needs to be a resolution.
Russ says, my understanding, this is to an earlier point that we made, my understanding is that the tariffs will be applied to all imported constituent parts used in assembling cars. My guess is that the importing car company would need to report those imported parts and provide a value to the government. Would there not be a big incentive to try and game the numbers?
You could probably try to game the numbers. I don't know how you do that when, you know, it's not like these parts are easily accessible from domestic suppliers or other places. Like, yeah, people game the tax system. Imagine that. Yeah. So, of course, this will happen.
We go to Gene. Trump wants to crash the economy and dole out favors for cash. The oligarchs want it to all crash down. Read about Curtis Yarvin and the Tech Brothers Project 2025. The oligarchs will gut and privatize everything after a crash. Putin also wants our economy and democracy to crash and burn. Don't overanalyze it. The point is to destroy it all.
It's not a very good legacy, though.
No, it's not nearly. I don't know. I think hopefully we can talk about it in a little more detail, that it's all going to crash and burn. David says tariffs are a tool for what exactly? Leverage to obtain what? Disruption to what end? the U.S. doesn't have the raw materials, the factories, or the workforce to produce the 70% of what makes up the domestic automotive industry. New factories will take decades and be peopled with what workers? We are at 4% unemployment now. This is a bloody mess brought upon us by an imbecile. That's from David. All right. Hearing nothing?
Don't look at the headline numbers. 4% is a low unemployment number by historical standards. But behind that is hidden a lot of labor market slack. What we mean by that is that on the sidelines, there are a lot of people who are discouraged but want to actually have employment. And I've been looking at those numbers. They've been ticking up for about the last 2 years. More and more people are being discouraged by the prospects of finding a good job in the labor market. Then there are a whole bunch of people who are part-time, we call them for economic reasons, involuntarily part-time. They want a full-time job. They want a good paying job. They can't find it. Those numbers have been going up since 2022. So, and then there are some people who just don't happen to be looking in the survey week, which is a very short time period for measuring unemployment. So there are others who are also available. I think the issue is whether you can find enough people to work for low-paying jobs. I mean, manufacturing jobs are high-paying jobs. They're better-paying jobs, and there is some skill and retraining. There is some restructuring that needs to happen, retraining, as we were talking earlier. But it's not to say that we don't have those who are willing to take them. We just need to, have policy for, again, apprenticeships, vocational training, to be able to transition them into those jobs.
Let's go back to the letters. We go to Allison, who says, won't AI take most of the manufacturing jobs that the current regime wants to bring back? This is a point you were making earlier.
Whether AI will look, I mean, AI.
No, I mean, not AI specifically, but that the technology would allow that there not to be the number of jobs that perhaps we're counting on.
Look, I think that it's not about volume of jobs. AI will change and displace some jobs. And AI will simultaneously create jobs we couldn't even think of today. I think people's grievance is that AI is not necessarily improving the way that we experience the economy, right? You get on the phone and you get some pre-recorded message. Right? You don't have somebody on the other side of the line, so you could talk to somebody about your health insurance that you could, or some customer service. AI has automated a whole bunch of customer service jobs, but it's created jobs in programming and some other areas. The question is how AI is actually making the quality of our life better or worse. And I think on balance, I wouldn't be worried about the volume of jobs. It is basically the jobs that we end up creating, whether they're good jobs.
Yeah, I think the reason people look to manufacturing jobs as being the gold standard in terms of good jobs is just because of the history of U.S. economic evolution. Those were the good jobs, meaning they paid a living wage, they provided health benefits, they provided pensions, they provided job security, primarily because of unions, that existed in the 50s, 60s, and then you start to see the decline of that. So that's kind of what people look back to in history is, well, these were the good jobs. But that does not mean that you can't turn a service sector job a janitorial job into a good job, right? No. I mean, depending on how you define a good job, most economists would probably say living wage, healthcare benefits, pension. You can turn any job into a good job, whether it's a manufacturing job or not. The key is that for manufacturing jobs, historically, it was the ticket to a middle-class lifestyle without necessarily having to acquire a college degree, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't mean that those are unskilled workers. In fact, it means quite the opposite. So the concept of creating good jobs, I think, needs to be broadened, that it's not just manufacturing. Yeah. I mean, obviously, yes, we need manufacturing to make stuff. That's fine. But we also need services, too. So like, an entry level receptionist at a doctor's office could have a high quality job if the doctor's office paid a living wage and provided health care and pension benefits. But that's something that doesn't happen. So bringing back manufacturing jobs, I think, is just code and shorthand for saying we need to create better quality jobs.
Well, there are some other, manufacturing jobs do have a multiplier effect because of supply chain, because of the related spend. Yeah. So there is an impact on the economy that a service job doesn't necessarily have. But a manufacturing job actually creates the opportunity for more service sector jobs,
right?
Which is a very good thing, right? So it makes for a robust. But I will tell you, in talking to our manufacturers, the desire to work from home, not something you can generally do in manufacturing, and the desire to not have to come in at 7 a.m. People have a often incorrect view of what a manufacturing floor looks like. I think they're awesome. I go, I tour them, and I want to do lean manufacturing in my house. Like, I want to have little tape outlines of where things go. So, there's some really amazing high skill technical jobs that happen in these facilities, and they're often very nice. But the perception of manufacturing as sort of, the assembly line from the 1940s has led people to turn away from these kinds of jobs in the U.S. And again, sometimes their shifts start early, like 7 a.m. Sometimes they work on Saturdays. And more people coming into the workforce don't want to do those things. And so it makes it harder to fill positions.
Here, I'd agree with you. AI can be really, technology automation can be very effectively used, especially for dangerous jobs, metals processing, right? Or even installation of electric wires. We shouldn't be hoisting a person yay high. And, there has to be some good automated solution. And I think that the reason why people are anxious about this is because they don't see another engine of creating the employment opportunities that might be displaced. But as Aaron was just saying, actually the economy, the vast majority of employment happened to be elsewhere. Healthcare is really it. 24 million people are working in healthcare in the service sector. I said 80%, but I think it's 70% of employment is service sector. Healthcare is the largest category. Business and professional services, which are linked to some manufacturing, but they're linked to just the overall economy. Right. That's the second largest category. And then you've got leisure and hospitality. And so, we can have various policies that are directed to those sectors to provide better healthcare. We can have community clinics, which are essential in these, what you call them, healthcare deserts across the country, where we can provide accessible, low-cost healthcare. We're not thinking in those terms. And these are the biggest grievances for the electorate. Healthcare costs were the second most important grievance after the economy, which really is code for my paycheck doesn't go far enough, my job is really not great. And so, we're not, and the thing is, this is something that both Democrats and Republicans do. They pay lip service to manufacturing because it has been a model of success. But, the world has moved on, and we have many other areas of the economy that need support. And 60% of workers in the United States earn less than $25 an hour. Mm. So when we're talking, and that's not in manufacturing, right? These are well-paying jobs. So when we're talking about pocketbook economics, is Trump delivering for the working class? This is who we should be talking about. Those folks are not in manufacturing. They are primarily in services.
All right. A few quick letters, and then we'll move on. Peter says Trump doesn't care about alliances Trump doesn't care about alliances because they are between equal partners. He doesn't want that. He wants to dominate. His idea of a good deal is when he wins and the other party loses. He believes that in every case, the other partner in an alliance needs the U.S. more than we need them. Then, yes.
And I think that's an excellent point and very much true. And it demonstrates the predatory nature of this administration that assumes that the power that we have is permanent, even if we lose our allies. Our power as a superpower stems from our alliances. And I'm just going to very quickly remind us of an earlier action of this administration when the Trump administration sent a military plane to Colombia.
with immigrants who were sent back. Now, this is nothing new. The Biden administration sent planes twice a week to Colombia. But what was different was the military plane, which was unannounced. when Colombia sent the plane back, the Trump administration threatened them with very high tariffs. And Colombia backed down and said, send the military plane. But in the same breath, they said, we need to look for new partners, and China is right there. Mm-hmm. China is investing in Latin America and is becoming more and more present. I've seen it in the sub-Saharan African region as well. And there is a growing openness toward seeing China as a more trustworthy ally than the United States. So it is backfiring.
Let us go to another topic, and we have just about 8 minutes before the break that we have to take. And this one is a story that Aaron sent me about the so-called X date, which I didn't know what that is. But the Congressional Budget Office said that the so-called X date could occur as early as spring if Congress does not lift or suspend the nation's debt limit. So the X date is the United States running out of cash. And that is possible that we will run out of cash by May, according to the budget office. That, Aaron, sounds bad.
It is bad. we've dug this hole for ourselves. As a country, more generally, but in having elected an administration that seems wildly incompetent. Now, I think Scott Bessent probably has a good understanding of how this works. But to give a very quick summary of what the X date is and why it exists, it has to do with the United States being one of only two countries in the world that has a debt ceiling. Denmark's the only other country. The debt ceiling came about during World War I, so that Congress didn't have to approve every new loan or bond issuance to help fund the war effort. So it was, okay, we're going to create this debt ceiling so Congress can just do these blanket approvals as long as it doesn't exceed, I'm not going to use X, Z amount. Well, that stuck with us. So now we have this perverse procedure where Congress, the president proposes a budget, Congress approves it. That's an agreement to spend in the upcoming fiscal year, say, $7 trillion on all of these different programs. But there's a second layer, that once Congress approves the budget, Congress then has to approve an increase in the debt ceiling to accommodate the spending that they've already approved, which essentially gives the Treasury Department permission to issue bonds to help fill whatever gap exists between the budget Congress passed and the difference between the debt ceiling. So it's a very antiquated idea that existed to make Congress's job more easier, and it has morphed into a weapon of political and economic warfare, where, you know, it really began in earnest in the 20-teens with John Boehner and the Tea Party they were threatening that, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling for President Obama and Congress unless we get these concessions. So it's a bargaining chip. Well, the consequence of that is that if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling, then all of a sudden the Treasury Department needs to figure out, well, we can't issue any more bonds to pay for things Congress already authorized. So we have to do all of these accounting maneuvers and start rearranging money so that we can do this. Well, at some point, if Congress doesn't approve an increase in the debt ceiling, then the Treasury Department is not going to be able to finance the things Congress has approved, which includes, some things might be exempt because Social Security payments come from a different stream of funding. But more importantly would be interest payments to U.S. bondholders. So that constitutes a default. And when there's the threat of default, interest rates spike because all of a sudden perceived risk goes up, and that can lead to an economic meltdown because U.S. Treasury bills are used in a lot of global as collateral for pretty much every type of loan. So that's the primer on the debt ceiling. It's an outdated idea, and it's used as a weapon to allow one party to get something they want by threatening to fail to, like, they're pushing, they've got their finger right on the nuclear button. If you don't give me this, then here's what's going to happen. So it boils down to a debate between government spending and tax revenue and how governments fund their operation.
Well, Elon Musk is going to save $2 trillion.
Oh, that's right.
So
I forgot about that.
It shouldn't be a problem, right?
Yep.
Right? I mean, I think he's almost done, right?
We don't know.
Look, as a technical, as a practical matter, it is not possible for the United States to run out of cash. That is just virtual impossibility.
Because cash, we just make more?
We make more. The government has the exclusive power to make currency. That is in the Constitution. That is in the Federal Reserve Act. It is the sole authority that can issue dollars or electronic dollars called reserves. So I think the debt ceiling is, as Aaron said, just a weapon, a political weapon, and it is an antiquated limit, which has been in over 100 years raised over 100 times. It tells you how useful it is. But I think the public really has trouble understanding why the heck it is there and what borrowing is. And so just think of, you know, as Aaron said, Congress passes a budget and they say these are policy priorities. You disagree, you agree or disagree, this is what we want to spend on. And then they send instruction to the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, please pay the bills. So what ends up happening is, you know, I get a Social Security check, you get a contract, somebody else gets a pandemic check, whatever it is, we all get payments. And the way we get payments is that the bank of the government credits my account. That's what ends up happening, right? The government sends me $100, and then when I pay my taxes, I pay $80. And the difference is what we call the deficit, right? The government somehow spent more than it got back from me, but the $20 are sitting in my pocket, right?
You got to get a better accountant, I would say. So, if you're at the 80% tax bracket.
What I'm saying is this, for purposes of illustration, the U.S. government runs a deficit. It is very rare for the government to balance its books or to run a surplus. The one time, and think about it, when the government runs a surplus, it means it's taxing more from the aggregate economy than it's putting back in. It's like a giant vacuum. It is sucking out income and purchasing power, but in the name of what? To fix the budget, what the government is doesn't have the household budget, doesn't have the same budget that you and I have. The government actually pays for its bills with its own bank. It is self-financing. So what the public doesn't quite understand is that, you know, if you put in 100 and you take back 80, right, for the purposes of illustration, there's going to be an overdraft, right? And the law instructs the government to sell bonds to basically soak up back some of those savings that are sitting in bank accounts and just, replace them with bonds. So bonds are not a way of raising cash for the government, but just to make sure that the account of the government zeroes out. It's an accounting requirement. It's not a financing requirement.
We're right up against a break, so I'll hold you there and we'll continue the conversation when we come back. We welcome you to the conversation panel at WAMC.org. First, BBC News. Ah, oh, man, that's great. That was very nice of you, Mike, to play that for Aaron, who had requested that earlier in the program. As it was coming on, Aaron looks at me and says, "This guy is the guitarist from Slayer."
Kerry King played guitar on that track. That's just the crossover, man.
Very, very cool. Good stuff.
You opened a can of worms. That's just not going to show.
That's good. I'm good. I'm good with this can of worms. We welcome you to the program panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I cut you off because we had to go to a break. You had a couple of points. There's a lot I want to talk to you about because we were talking about it during the break. But one thing is like this idea of, you know, we just made more money. But like, for example, COVID. Yes.
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Exactly. Right. I think this is the most recent teachable moment. In 12 months, I can list the six congressional acts that were passed in 6 months. In 12 months, we passed $5.5 trillion of government spending, which was about a quarter of the economy. This is wartime level spending. Now, how did we pay for this? And how come we didn't have this discussion about, you know, where do we fund the money? Nobody called a rich person and said, would you please give us some money so that we can spend on pandemic checks? We didn't look for the money under the mattress, right? The government passed a law. This was legally authorized payment. It sent instructions to the Treasury, and the Federal Reserve cleared all the payments. And the way it works is you get a credit to your account. That's it. Simple. That did create a deficit. That did create a large deficit. We can discuss whether the spending was appropriately directed, good, bad, the effect on the economy. But the pay for question should be settled just by that one example, because the government has given itself these exclusive powers to issue the currency and to be the sole issuer of these electronic dollars. So, you know, it's a technical design that we've created so that we can finance emergencies, laws, policy priorities. That's it. So we are not dependent on other creditors. Now, if you, you know, if you're, and then, as I said, the borrowing is just soaking up some of these extra money that is that are laying around in various accounts to provide an interest alternative. And there's a legal requirement to borrow. So there are, you know, there are reasons why it exists, but they are not economic reasons. They are political in architecture reasons by historical accident. So I think that's the first thing that, you know, and this was explained very clearly. If those of you who might remember the 2008 crisis, Ben Bernanke was called on 60 Minutes and was asked, like, where do we get the money? Was this taxpayer money? And Ben Bernanke at the time, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, says, no, it's not taxpayer money. We just use the computer to mark up the account where the payment is directed. So it's a technical impossibility for the U.S. to run out of cash. I think the question we should be having is, where should we spend the money? You know, what is the economic impact? If people are concerned about the size of the deficit, you know, that's a different matter. And, you know, it could be too big. It could be too small. But that's not the conversation we're having. People are saying, we're running out of money. We can't afford this. We got to make slash and burn politics of Musk and company are all in the name of finding the money. We've got the money, and this is a pretext. This is a false pretense to just destroy the safety net, essentially.
Okay, you mentioned Elon Musk. According to Fortune magazine, Elon Musk claimed 14 computers of the Department of Treasury and other government agencies just, quote, send money out of nothing, during a podcast appearance with Ted Cruz on Monday. He appeared to be criticizing the government's bookkeeping, though it's worth noting the government can, in fact, print money at little to no cost. He said he and Doge found 14, quote, magic money computers.
I want one of those.
How do exactly. We get one of those?
Me too, yes.
14 does not sound like enough.
No.
14 magic money computers that create money out of thin air.
This is it? This is it. He discovered what Ben Bernanke has been telling us. And what, you know, anyone who works at the Fed knows that, in fact, we don't have printing presses rolling up and just filling up wheelbarrows with cash. We just use computers to create dollars, yes, indeed, out of thin air, to make payments.
Has anyone in this room actually seen one of the magic machines?
I have not seen one of the magic money machines.
Field trip.
But, yes, field trip, exactly. But, yeah, I mean, the system is based on credits and debits. That's what the financial system is.
So, and I apologize if I'm being thick on this, but what you said before I entered the magic money machine into the equation is that this is what Elon Musk is looking for, are these ways to save money. But then when you go and say that you have a magic money machine that just makes money, then doesn't that dilute your argument?
It seems to me that he doesn't understand the financial architecture, how our financial system works, and he wants to disrupt it at all costs. If you prevent the government from making a payment that it has legally authorized, that has enormous repercussions, not only on the people who are dependent on those payments. I mean, this is a legal question, number one. But number two, it does disrupt markets which depend on the capacity of the U.S. government to maintain its full faith and credit. you know, people talk a lot about the 14th Amendment, you know, the birthright citizenship, but they don't remember that there is a clause there that says the debts of the U.S. government shall not be questioned. And so long as the U.S. government borrows in its own currency, it can't default on its debts. And we've designed this system deliberately to make sure that we are always able to pay in our own currency. If you borrow in another currency, you can default on your debts. But in your own, you use your computer and you make the legally authorized payment to whoever that may be.
And at no time during any of this did Ted Cruz turn to Elon Musk and say, "What are you talking about, Willis?"
No, no, they were. They were flabbergasted that that payments are created electronically. And I don't know any other way in which you can create a payment. You do credit somebody's account.
So I see I understand that a government can't default when it issues its own currency, technically. Could a government choose to default?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And this is what they're trying to do.
Right,
yes,
exactly. There's a distinction between
that. That's right. So they're engineering a political crisis, as they're doing with virtually every other policy. It is basically defund and destroy. But this is far more serious than almost anything else, because the entire global financial system depends on the U.S. the faith and credit of the U.S. government. And so, you know, once you meddle with, you know, when you snoop into Social Security and you look at people's information and you try to disrupt that system, then you create doubt in the system and people then start questioning, will my Social Security be there, right? This is an old Republican strategy. This is old Reaganism, if you will. But when you do that for the payment system for the United States, you're seeding doubt and the kind of uncertainty that we hadn't seen since before the Great Depression to in fact, you know, make our trade partners, contractors, anyone basically be doubtful whether they will get a payment in their bank account, whether the check will clear, whether it will clear at par, right, whether the money will be there. That is fundamentally disruptive to the entire architecture of the financial system.
Yeah, when you talk about being disruptive, it's like when we swipe a credit card, right, there's no cash that exchanges hands. There's a whole financial plumbing in there that rests on the ability of U.S. government bonds to be exchanged by banks as collateral.
Correct.
Same thing with direct deposits. So when we talk about this, it's this big, heady, abstract concept of default and interest rates and disruption to the global financial system. You know, I mean, that could mean like all of a sudden Stewart's stops accepting credit card payments for gas, or your direct deposit doesn't go through. I mean, there are real consequences to this that boil down to how people experience their life on a daily basis and what they just take for granted.
Exactly.
And it's because of this whole architecture that Pavlina was describing.
I do want to end this part of the conversations because we only have 5 minutes left, and I do want to bring this up. But the Elise Stefanik pulled a nomination for... If you remember the way this story broke down, is that Elise Stefanik, who is the congresswoman from our district, I'm pointing to Aaron, the 21st Congressional District here in New York State, was nominated to be the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Then, last week, they said that because there was an article in the New York Times that said she was the only one who had been chosen that had not yet gone through a confirmation hearing. That was quickly followed up by an announcement that the hearing and the subsequent approval would probably come on April 4th. Then, yesterday, the White House made, as the Washington Post refers to it, as the shocking announcement that it was pulling Stefanik's nomination to become U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And the reason is because they didn't want to spare her vote, even for just the period between her resignation and a special election, because that House Republican majority is so, so narrow. Heather.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many aspects to it. I think the concept that there was a potential that the special election was going to be delayed as long as possible to basically keep the seat empty which makes the, you know, the majority that much slimmer. I mean, this is a district that in all likelihood will be won by a Republican. There are some concerns, actually, because there were two potential candidates, and one was one of the guys was saying he was going to run as an independent, which could potentially divide the Republican vote. And also the fundraising activities in Florida have basically illustrated that there's not right now a huge appetite for people to support Republicans. So there's a whole pile of concerns that kind of all coalesced for this to happen. I always feel like, you know, it for an administration to take people out of the legislature, and we've seen it at the state level before, it is a high-risk endeavor because you may end up losing some of the voting authority that you can expect from your party if you do that.
Two quick points. I mean, one is they knew the numbers pretty much. I mean, they were going to vary, but they knew the numbers when she was initially announced.
I do think the fundraising piece is more significant than people have let on. I mean, Florida, the two districts that the fundraising is really behind are both super, super red districts. Ruby red is, you know, how they get referred to. And they're very much underperforming as they go into specials in those two districts. So, you know, there's a concern that we're having maybe an early midterm effect because of all the disruptions that are happening. And, you know, we've all seen, I hope, some of the town hall, you know, the very unhappy populace. Mm-hmm. There is, I mean, even in this district, there's, you know, a playbook by which it doesn't end up red. I think very, very unlikely. But having the seat open and then you're stuck with the possibility that someone is sick and can't make a vote when you've got things coming up like the tax bill, which is a super important bill. If they don't do something with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and it expires, there will be a massive tax increase on business, a massive tax increase. And despite what everyone says, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act only benefited the high income earners. There is a large percentage of the population that will see a very large and dramatic tax increase if they don't get this bill through. So there are some really important things that they need to get done this year. They know that, you know, next year is an election year. And that makes it harder to get things done, and it's going to be a midterm. It's very unlikely that they keep the House.
She appeared on Fox News last night, and even on Fox News website, there was a comment section, and the interview, you could watch the interview, and one of the comments was, wow, she seems to smile a lot with that knife in her back.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that she was aware, and I'm sure that there's a future promise for something for her. She's been very loyal to this administration.
Absolutely.
She's a very, very intelligent person, very smart. And I'm sure, you know, while she can't be super happy about this, that she understands the significance of, you know, having that seat sit empty.
All right. We are out of time. I'll let you go get your phone.
Yep.
thanks to everyone this morning, Heather, Aaron, Karen, Pavlina, you're all wonderful. I so appreciate you being here and sharing your expertise. We'll be back right after this.